This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In January, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, made five pledges, the greatest of which was to halve inflation by the end of 2023. It was just over 10% then, and most forecasters saw getting it down to just over 5% as an easy win. They're not saying that now. We're halfway through the year and inflation is a grim 8.7%. So how have we got this so very wrong? Can we fix it? And what does it mean for the UK economy if we can't, or even if we can? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's look at the recent story of inflation here and abroad. Joining me are Merrin Khan, economics editor at The Times, and Duncan Weldon, economist and author of An Economic History of Britain, 200 Years of Muddling Through. Merrin Khan, we can obviously, all of us, remember a very recent time when inflation was just hovering above 0%. And I think we thought it'd stay that way forever. When did it start going up significantly?
Well, looking back at the charts of inflation, we can see a clear trend upwards around the summer of 2021. So we saw inflation exceed around 2% in June, again in July, and then it basically just rockets up into an upward trajectory, which ends with an 11.1% peak of inflation in October 2022. And since that point, at the beginning of 2022, we've had a response from the Bank of England. But actually, despite all the talk about the war being the primary cause of inflation, which was definitely the case last year, the increase or the slight upsurge in inflation was happening just before the end of lots of lockdowns across Europe and in the UK in the summer of 2021, where people were probably going around and doing their business a bit more than they were earlier in the year. And the interesting thing about that inflation, it was also an energy-driven inflation.
So to get this absolutely clear, we have a significant inflationary rise before the Ukraine war, which is largely down to energy prices. Are there any other things which are causing inflation to rise significantly before the war?
We know that during the pandemic, lots of people were stuck at home and they still had quite a lot of spending power because they were saving money by not going on their daily commute. And people were spending that money on goods because it was the only thing that was really available to them. So goods price inflation, which is the price of just stuff, this was a component of inflation which was going up steadily and was very much expected because central bankers and government and the economists understood that a lot of the consumer power was only being concentrated on goods rather than services. But the energy price story was because people were going out again, their energy usage was increasing. People had to fill up their cars once more. I, you know, distinctly remember a conversation in the UK and in Europe in the winter of 2021 about the massive surge in energy prices and the governments had to do something about this. And this was much, much before the record upshot that we saw a few months later. So we were already having something akin to a, you know, domestic energy crisis story much before the war in Ukraine.
Right. Duncan, also before the war in Ukraine, was inflation going up in other comparable countries?
Yeah, sort of the broad picture is from the sort of the banking crisis of 2008, 2009 onwards, sort of every advanced economy then had about a decade of really low inflation. And in fact, many economists worrying that inflation was too low, that we risked a period of falling prices. That all changes during the pandemic. You get, you know, what we learned is turning modern economies on and off isn't just like flipping a switch. And as lockdowns ended, demand recovered a lot faster than supply recovered. So we started to see this big pickup in inflation across pretty much every advanced economy starting around the spring, the summer of 2021.
Right. And by roughly the same amounts in these countries.
Yes. So if you look across North America, across Europe, across Britain, you get this sort of big pickup from inflation being around 2% in the spring of 2021 to being up towards double digits or getting into double digits by the middle of 2022. Now, I think it's important to say, although inflation was high everywhere, there were different types of inflation about. So in Europe, it was really very much an energy price story. In North America, it looked to be much more a domestically generated inflation story, a story of there being a shortage of workers, firms having to put up wages, that increasing their costs, then putting up their prices to try and protect their profit margins. Britain, interestingly, had a bit of both. We had the sort of European-style energy price shock coupled with that American-style worker shortage.
Now, Maureen, the Russia-Ukraine war started in February 2022. What was the UK inflation rate at that point?
The inflation rate just before the war was at 6.2%, which is more than three times the Bank of England's 2% target. And actually, the Bank of England had started to raise interest rates before the war in Ukraine. So they actually did their first interest rate increase in a long time from 0.1% to 0.25% in December 2021, so a few months ahead of the war in Ukraine. And that, as we've already mentioned, is because there was an existing upsurge in inflation, which was coming from energy prices. So even before the war in Ukraine, British consumers and the central bank would have seen that these energy costs are going in the wrong direction. And therefore, they started to tighten monetary policy. And interestingly, even though the bank has been very heavily criticized, they did do this tightening process much earlier than the European Central Bank, which only raised rates around 7 months later in July 2022, and the US Federal Reserve, which only started raising interest rates in March 2022. So, you know, the bank was actually first to this, and some people said they were already late in December 2021, but they really did sort of buck a global trend by going early.
Duncan, can we do some comparisons at February 2022? Maureen has told us that the inflation rate in the UK was 6.2%. What was it in the US and in, say, Germany and France, comparable countries?
It was 8.9% across the Atlantic in North America. Across the Eurozone as a whole, it was 6.2%. More specifically, it was 5.5% in Germany, 4.2% in France. So it was a little lower in France and Germany than in Britain, but a bit higher in the United States.
Right. Now, Maureen, you've pinpointed that inflation was on a significant rise before the Ukraine war started. But the UK and US rises are really quite dramatic. What was different about what policy was in the UK and the US from what happened, say, in Europe?
I think it's important to understand the structure of the energy market in the UK compared to European countries. So in countries like France, in particular, Spain, Portugal, you have consumers who are locked in to energy contracts, which means that they will not really be exposed to all the vicissitudes of market movements in natural gas prices, because they have a system whereby they're relatively protected because you can get contracts that go up to a decade. In the UK, because of the nature of the way the price cap works, the British consumer is much more vulnerable to immediate changes in market prices, which then are reflected in your energy bill, you know, up to a month or 2 months or 3 months later. That's not always the case in continental Europe. And then we have this secondary element, which is about the domestic drivers of inflation. And that's very much about the fact that despite the war in Ukraine, despite higher borrowing costs, the UK's labour market has been relatively resilient. Unemployment is close to record lows at just above 3.5%. And there's the additional element, which we haven't mentioned so far, which is Brexit. So during the pandemic, of course, very few people could move around, but the UK did lose its ability to access workers from the European Union who were taking advantage of free movement of labour. And this historically has been a huge driver of productivity growth and general growth in the UK because of the number of people that come and work here. That's also helped and contributed to the tight labour market. And maybe just quickly on the US, in early 2021, the Biden administration unleashed a $2 trillion package, rescue package, to get the American economy back on its feet, putting direct money into people's bank accounts through stimulus checks throughout 2021. And that may have helped contribute to this sort of overheating in the US labor market.
So, Merin, you don't think that, for example, the amount of money that the government paid to people to furlough people during the pandemic contributed in any significant way?
I think furlough had an interesting and I think unexpected impact on the labour market. And the Bank of England is now acknowledging that it expected the end of furlough, so around September 2021, to coincide with a small or, you know, even a sizable increase in unemployment, as all of those jobs that were retained were then no longer under the furlough scheme. So the bank expected unemployment to go up, and therefore they weren't really preparing to raise interest rates at this time. They thought this would be something that would slow down the economy in the autumn of 2021. And, you know, a few years later, the bank now acknowledges that did not happen. Companies kept hold of workers, and they did that because they were, one, afraid they would not be able to rehire people once the economy improves, and two, that they understood that there was a labour shortage in the UK. So getting rid of people, you know, having layoffs was not the best way to try and sort of repair the headcount that you lost in those pandemic years. And that's still a trend we see today.
Duncan, let's now look at once the Ukraine war has started after the Russian invasion. Inflation rates continue to climb in the countries we've been talking about after the war began. Can you just take us through briefly the variations in inflation since that period and then attribute a cause to them?
Yeah, so let's start with the United States. So, you know, in February 2022, as the invasion starts, US inflation was running at an annual rate of 8.9%. It continued to rise before sort of hitting its peak early that summer, just above 10%, and has been falling since. Inflation also continued to rise in Britain, in France, in Germany, and the peaks there came a bit later than the US, sort of in the autumn, the winter. German inflation peaked at 11.6%, French peaked at 7.1%, and Britain just above 11%. So the general trend is that inflation continued to rise after the war. It got to a slightly higher level in Europe than in the United States, and the peak came a bit later in Europe than in the United States. The United States is in a different position in global energy markets. It's got a lot of shale gas, you know, certainly not reliant on Russian gas. So that sort of the price shock from the war in Ukraine hit Europe harder than North America.
Right. So let's bring it up to date. What's happened to inflation in the US since the beginning of this year? What's happened in Germany and France, and what's happened here?
Okay. So in North America, inflation has been falling quite quickly this year. So in December last year, US inflation was still at 6.1%. As of May, it had fallen to just 2.7%, getting back towards that sort of more historically normal, comfortable 2% level. It's more than halved. In Europe, there's also been a fall in inflation. So in Germany, it's down from 9.6% to 6.3%, sort of similar fall in France, down from 6.7 down to 6%. So, you know, inflation is about 6% in Europe. It's fallen. It has fallen in Britain, but at a more sluggish pace. So at the very end of last year, consumer price inflation in Britain was 10.5%. As of May, it's what, 8.7%. So there's been a fall, but a much slower fall than we've seen in Europe, and a much, much slower fall than we've seen in the United States.
Right. So to you, Merin, goes the $64 million question, although I suspect by the end of it, it's the $65 million question, which is, why is the UK struggling with inflation compared to the other countries right now?
There's a new phrase which has sort of always lingered in the inflationary panic that the UK has suffered, and that's this thing called second round effects. And this is a general phrase which describes what happens when you have an initial external shock, which in this case is an energy price shock, which raises the prices of energy. People experience high inflation. And then that trickles into different parts of the economy which are related to energy, so things like transportation, food, the cost of goods. Generally, we're also seeing the record prices of food. Food price inflation peaked around March at 19.2%. It is coming down very slowly. It's just at 18.4% as of May. And this is the sort of more generalized inflation inflation phenomena, which central banks, you know, this is the stuff that really keeps them up at night. And I think the pernicious thing about second round effects is that if you've already begun to see them, then to some degree, it's already a little bit too late. And now the Bank of England is constantly talking about the fact that it is going to have to do more than it expected in terms of monetary tightening only a few months ago, that the financial markets also expected to do more. It's likely to be raising interest rates long after the US Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank perhaps take a pause on their own tightening cycle. So despite going first, it's probably going to be the last major central bank to exit its monetary tightening regime. And that's because this generalized inflation phenomena seems to have set in. And there's various reasons we can say why this has happened. I think the bank will say we are in such uncertain times that this was difficult to foresee and to forecast. But what seems to be happening is that consumers, despite people like me telling them on a daily basis that the economy is slowing and that we're having lots of high inflation and borrowing costs are going up, they're still spending. They're still spending on goods, which is keeping goods price inflation high, and they're definitely spending on services. So they're doing all the things that they couldn't really do during the pandemic. So we know that people actually managed to accumulate quite a lot of savings during the pandemic. And now it seems that they're dipping into those savings to maintain a lot of their purchasing power, even as the cost of everything seems to be going up.
Marion, we'll come on to some of those points in a moment. But I think this is the point at which we should really, Duncan, dig into the question of interest rates. And the first question I want to ask you, because it's been asked, not least by a listener who's emailed in, is, are there policies which ministers themselves can pursue that are inflationary or counter-inflationary?
The short answer is yes. Now, the way we've tended to run our sort of overall economic policy since the 1990s is to say that inflation is the job of the Bank of England, and it uses interest rates and monetary policy to manage inflation. And that's not really the job of the government. And there are really, really sound reasons why economists tend to think that managing inflation is a job best done by central bankers. The whole idea is that central bankers can be sort of neutral technocrats who don't care about being unpopular in a way that politicians can't. Now, the government's wider sort of fiscal policy, its tax and spend, does have an influence here. If the government is increasing spending or cutting taxes, that is putting more demand, more money into the economy, which should, to use an economist's favourite phrase, all things being equal, push inflation higher and mean the Bank of England has to go further and faster on interest rates to bring inflation down. So if the government wanted to directly try and bring inflation down, it could be cutting its own spending. It could be putting taxes up, neither of which, of course, would be very popular measures with many people. And although they might help bring inflation down, they would obviously make sort of economic growth that much harder.
Although the alternative to it, increasing interest rates, also makes growth harder.
It's very easy to say the Bank of England should put up interest rates to bring down inflation because everyone wants inflation to come down. But of course, it's quite painful medicine. It may be necessary medicine, but it is painful. And that pain is a feature, not a bug. To bring down inflation, the Bank of England puts up interest rates, so it will be harder for firms to borrow, to invest, to expand, to hire people. So it will be harder for households to borrow money to spend, so that the income of people with mortgages will be reduced, so they can spend less money elsewhere. You know, we've been speaking a lot today about the headline rate of inflation, whereas what central bankers tend to be concerned about is something called core inflation. Core inflation is inflation if you exclude energy and food prices. Now, it might sound to people listening at home, why on earth would you exclude energy and food prices? That's quite a big proportion of my spending, especially at the moment. Well, the argument for that is energy and food prices, firstly, tend to be very volatile. So if you're just looking at core inflation, you get a slightly stabler measure of inflation. But more importantly, energy and food prices tend to be governed by sort of global factors. So if you're looking at core inflation, excluding energy and food, you're getting a better read on what you might think of as sort of domestically generated inflation. So by looking at core inflation, we're saying, okay, once these big energy price shocks and food price shocks have passed, at what sort of level is inflation going to be? And if that's still a high level, then central banks would traditionally think they need a bit more rises in interest rates to push down that level of core inflation.
Right, Merin, finally, if core inflation is pretty high here in the UK, and I believe that it is, are we going to see a situation like in America where even if the overall inflation rate is falling, the Bank of England is going to be inclined to keep interest rates pretty high?
Yes, I think the US is a relatively good gauge for where we may be heading. The Bank of England doesn't expect its headline inflation rate to hit 2% by 2025. So they don't actually forecast core inflation, but we know that, you know, core inflation has been historically in the last couple of months higher than headline inflation. Core inflation hit 7.1% in May, which is the highest in 31 years. And I think it's difficult sometimes for people who are just, you know, watching the news or trying to understand which is the preferred measure of inflation. So we've talked about headline, we've talked about core. And another element that the bank looks at is something called services inflation or core services inflation. And that's very important in a UK context because it's quite a good proxy for where wages in the, you know, predominant area of the UK economy, which is services, where they are going. So the bank thinks that services is a good measure to see whether a very labour-intensive industry, so there's loads of jobs and services in the UK, if they're experiencing high inflation, that probably means that companies are having to give out bigger wage packets to their employees, which then suggests that inflation might be much stickier than they thought.
Merin Khan there with Duncan Weldon. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about Yevgeny Prigozhin and the Wagner Group, the one asking how successful the online safety bill will be, and the one about Donald Trump's legal woes. Right, now we've understood the inflation problem, I want to look at what high inflation means for the economic outlook in the UK and for the world of politics. Joining me is Merin Somerset Webb, senior columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Merin Somerset Webb, why would Rishi Sunak have made halving inflation his number one priority at the beginning of the year when it's the Bank of England's job to deal with inflation rather than the government? And I suppose I'm asking, was it optics rather than anything else?
Yeah, I mean, that was a weird one, given that the Bank of England is specifically independent so that those of inflation is their task and only their task, and it doesn't get confused with government policy. So it's not really any of the Prime Minister's business how inflation is dealt with and how we get where we want to go. So that was a strange one, definitely optics, but he was in with a good chance when he said it because everyone expected inflation to halve by the end of the year anyway. So it could have been a very, very easy win for him.
So let's come on to that expectation. And part of that expectation is, of course, caused by Bank of England forecasting, which has, as I gather it, been consistently wrong, but always consistently wrong in the same direction.
Yes, absolutely, completely wrong at every turn and in the wrong direction. So the Bank of England has consistently expected inflation to fall back quite fast towards their target, which is 2%. And obviously, we're very significantly above that at the moment. They've persisted in believing that all the inflation that we've seen since 2021 has been transitory, that it will be gone quickly, that it's simply down to COVID reaction, down to global forces that are out of their control, that will gradually work their way through. And that'll be that. And we'll be back to what they consider to be normal. And obviously, it absolutely hasn't happened.
Now, if it's the forecasting has been wrong at every stage, there must have come a point when the Bank of England said our forecasting's not quite working.
Yes, they're getting to that bit. So they have now said that they're going to have an external review of their models and how they work. I mean, obviously, we're all hoping they do that really quickly because, you know, time's running out. We would have liked them to do it a little while ago. And one of the problems with it seems to be that the data that they use only goes back about 30 years. So they're looking for the inputs to their models at a very long period of very low inflation, which you can argue about why or how we've had very low inflation, but a lot of it has been down to big global effects as opposed to UK effects. So globalization, the huge expansion of the global workforce with the entry of China into the WTO, the opening up of the European Union to the Eastern countries, etc. All these things fed into a very low inflation environment and hence a very low interest rate environment. And what models do, all models can really do, is extrapolate from the data that is put into them. So they were unable, or appears they were unable, to forecast correctly given the huge changes that we've seen in the global and the domestic economy over the last few years. So yes, full failure there.
One of my reasons for asking was, in setting interest rate policy, have they not at all been guided by what their expectation of inflation would be rather than the forecast, which they already knew were likely to be wrong?
Well, I don't think they have believed that their forecasts would continue to be wrong. So expectations and forecasts are very bound up in each other. And of course, a model can never tell you exactly what's going to happen. It's only a model, but it does guide your expectations. So these things have been combined. And that's one of the reasons why they started to raise interest rates, most people would say, much too late. And there's a secondary thing in there, which is that the Bank of England no longer has very many monetarists in it, or people who believe that money supply is one of the drivers of inflation. So that's something that they've ignored the whole way through. And there's another group of economists who firmly believe that it is money supply that tells you what's going to happen to prices, who've been shouting as loudly as they possibly can since the middle of 2020, saying, look, money supply is rising incredibly fast. And that means that inflation is going to follow. And if you don't put that into your models, you're really missing a major trick. We're not alone in our central bank not getting things quite right. But it seems slightly worse here at the moment than elsewhere.
Okay, so I'm trying to work out what, if I were the Prime Minister, contemplating an election that has to be held before January 2025, or by January 2025, and therefore is more likely, let's say, in the autumn of next year, is going to be the background against which I go to the country economically.
If there is a chance, which there is, that inflation will start coming down from here, and if there is a chance that it won't go up particularly abruptly over the next year, then the best thing to do is to wait as long as possible. There's also likely to be a recession either way. You know, we're due a recession. A lot of weird stuff has happened in the global economy and the domestic economy over the last couple of years. Rising interest rates will have effects throughout the economy that we can't even quite contemplate yet. Remember that there is a whole generation of people who've never seen interest rates at these levels, who've never understood how inflation works. They've never really seen it. So we don't yet really know how people are going to behave around that. We also don't know how many businesses are going to survive interest rates going up to the kind of levels that they've been historically. Remember that until we started to raise interest rates recently, they were at 5,000-year lows and had been for quite a long time. That changes all sorts of things in the economy in ways that, again, we're not going to completely understand until we see what happens over the next few years. You know, we used to say, economists used to take out charts of interest rates and show the chart of it falling down to 3,000, 5,000-year lows and say, this is terrifying. But of course, the most terrifying thing is not them being that low and not really understanding what happens when rates are at these historical lows, but seeing them shoot back up again at one of the fastest rates we've ever seen and not really understanding what that sudden rise in interest rates does to the way businesses behave and the way individuals behave when it's a new dynamic for almost everybody.
Merrin, a paradox occurs to me. I don't know what you will think of it, but if you were the Labour Party, imagining that it's quite likely that you will be in power after the next election, you may be rather hoping that the government and the Bank of England does the interest rate dirty work now so that you don't have to do it and you reap the benefit of it later.
Absolutely. And if the Bank of England hasn't dealt with inflation fairly significantly by the time of the next election, we'll have to have a very long talk about Bank of England independence, I should think. So if you were Labour and you were thinking that you would win the next election, it's not going to be as bad as it might appear, assuming that the Bank of England does push interest rates up to the kind of level and, well, assuming that interest rates go up to the right level and that money supply keeps falling and that the global dynamics of pushing up energy prices, food prices, etc., stay going in the correct direction as they are at the moment. In a couple of years, you'll be much better off than you would if you went into government, say, now, which would be pretty awful.
Merrin Somerset-Webb. My thanks to her and to Duncan Weldon and Maureen Khan. And my conclusion is, you may not think you've been to a party, but it's over. The Briefing Room will be back again next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Claire Bowes. The editor was Richard Varden and the programme was mixed by James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
This is a new 5-part drama from Radio 4 called An Eye for a Killing. The true story of Scotland's most notorious serial killers, Burke and Hare. You might have heard their names. You might also have heard that they were 19th century grave robbers. They weren't. They didn't dig up a single body. They simply murdered for cash. 16 times. This is a haunting story of murder on an industrial scale. It's dark, frightening, and plumbs the terrible depths of human behaviour. Subscribe to An Eye for a Killing on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.